Before we begin talking about Roseanne, we want to say unequivocally that Black Lives Matter, trans women are women, and trans men are men.
Islamophobia and anti-Semitism have no place in this world. Families belong together and out of cages.
No human being is illegal. Clean water, healthcare, and education are basic human rights.
We stand with workers and unions, and Nazis will always be bad. Welcome to 714 Delaware Street. We're on episode 4. How does it feel, Catherine?
Hi, Mara.
Hi.
I'm excited about being on episode 4.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And we have put our earlier episodes up on iTunes, and we've got people who say they're listening, so we're really excited. And thank you guys for tuning in. If you're still with us here on episode 4, we really appreciate it. And yeah. The Conners is premiering very soon, so we're going to be talking about that shortly, October 16th.
That's right. I'm excited for sure.
Yeah, it'll be awesome. And we did want to acknowledge that another very big reboot just happened last night, the new Murphy Brown, which, of course,
right.
We both forgot to watch or didn't watch for various reasons.
Well, I wasn't feeling well.
That's right. Well, yeah, and it was also the night. I mean, it was just a total circus. We just had CNN on watching the Kavanaugh stuff and torturing ourselves.
Yeah.
So I totally forgot about Murphy Brown, but it'll be interesting to see how that goes. My mom liked it, and she was a loyal Murphy Brown fan of the original, so
Yeah, I'm definitely going to go back and watch. I did see a little sort of promo shot of Candace Bergen looking glorious in her Silver Fox, I guess it would actually be Silver Vixen hair.
Oh yeah, so I know. She looks great.
Yeah, she looks really good.
Do we have any idea who all's back? I guess we'll have to watch it.
We'll watch it and we'll talk about it next time.
We will. And so today what we're talking about is another classic Roseanne episode from season one. I think this is probably the last season one episode that we're going to talk about. But it's called Lover's Lane. And It revolves around bullying, like many sitcoms of the time, which we'll discuss in due time during this episode. But this episode is about the Conners are going, I guess the entire Conner family is going bowling, along with Jackie and Booker, the boss from Wellman Plastics, played by George Clooney, and also Crystal. So they're all going to the bowling alley, and there's a bunch of different things happening, different relationships, with a nice backdrop of just some relaxing bowling.
Yes.
And some great physical comedy from John Goodman, as usual.
Yeah, absolutely. Knocking it out of the park. Hitting all the pins.
Indeed. Well, and this is probably the episode where we see maybe the most of George Clooney so far. And he's definitely a very important part of this episode.
Yeah, he's key.
Yeah, so the beginning of the episode, we start in the workplace, which is Wellman Plastics. They're just kind of hanging around, though, in this episode. They don't really seem to be working. They're sort of on break. And it's Friday, so it's happy mood at Wellman Plastics. And then we meet some new characters. Pete, who we've never seen before that I can recall, I don't think, who is one of their coworkers.
Yeah, he is in there just occasionally spouting like gross misogynistic stuff.
So he's been in some other ones already.
Yeah. But this is a good one for him too.
Well, yeah, he says, so what are you girls doing tonight? And Roseanne says, well, we're going to go out and try to find some dim-witted bald guys. And Pete is bald, so that is kind of why that's funny. And then we meet Sylvia, who's another coworker of theirs, and she's an older woman. She's wearing a smock with bears on it, which I really liked.
It's so good.
And she's talking about, what did she say?
Well, because Pete's like, I'm going to go out and redefine manhood for some woman.
That's right. She's like, I could totally use a little gross manhood in my life. There's still some tread on these old tires.
Right. I love that. I just sort of expect her to start singing, "The old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be." Right. What she used to be. Even though her message is really the other way.
It's the opposite.
The old gray mare is what she used to be.
And how.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Silly is cool, and I wish that we could see a little bit more of her, but I think she kind of fades away into obscurity, sadly. And one of the things I love about this scene is Jackie's like, "Let's go dancing at the Night Monkey." And I seriously rewound it. I was just like, what did she say? The Night Monkey is the name of a club that Jackie wants to go to.
If only we had watched this episode sooner, we could have named our podcast The Night Monkey.
Right. And then everyone would have immediately gotten the reference. Amazing.
Of course. Yes.
Lanford's Hottest Dance Club.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I can totally imagine Stefan being like, "Lanford's new hottest nightclub is The Night Monkey."
That's right. Oh, man. It does sound like a place that would be in my hometown, actually. On the outskirts.
Sure. Well, we had a strip club called Jerry McNasty's.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that.
And one called the Appaloosa.
Ooh.
So Night Monkey's not that far off.
That's really not. Well, we just had Danceland, which is a country line dancing place. And it was really creepy because, like, girls that I knew in junior high would go there and they would meet, like, really, like, guys in their 20s and, ugh.
Yeah.
It was not wholesome. Like, you know, you think of the electric slide, you might think wholesome, but no.
Deeply not, no. They're two-stepping real close with some redheaded strangers.
That's right. So anyway, the Night Monkey, unfortunately, is not the setting for this episode. I really would have liked to have seen that. But we are, anyway, Roseanne, I think, is the one who suggests going bowling, and everybody's like, "No, we don't want to bowl with you," because Crystal says, "You have no respect for the sport." Because Roseanne is apparently always just being silly and, like, not being serious about bowling and trying to distract people while they're bowling and things like that.
Yeah, Crystal actually says, "All you ever do is poop all over the sport." She's deeply serious, Crystal, and bowling is no different. She's very serious about bowling.
Yeah, and I think Crystal pretty much is totally serious throughout this entire episode, to the point of almost being, like, upset.
Well, she gets upset later.
Yeah.
It's funny. Poor Crystal!
I know.
So high-strung.
But anyway, the big moment of this scene is that Roseanne asks Booker, who comes into the room to get some coffee, if he wants to go bowling with them. And he says yes, like, right away. And Jackie is excited about that a little bit.
Yeah, all of a sudden, Jackie wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't before. And then she's like, "Oh, yeah, we're going bowling."
And then they do some flirting by the coffee maker.
Indeed.
That's that. The seed is planted for a Booker and Jackie love connection.
At the bowling alley. Yes. I was actually looking up that the Pete character is played by an actor named Ron Perkins, because he did show up very briefly in an earlier episode that I watched that I don't think we've talked about. But he has been a guest on, like, single episodes of everything.
Of everything. He does look familiar.
Yeah. Well, most recently, he's been on a couple episodes of Modern Family. But he was on Doogie Howser. He was on Fresh Prince. He was on Dynasty. He was on Married with Children. He was on My Two Dads. He was on Northern Exposure, CSI, ER, wow. Grey's Anatomy, Felicity, NYPD Blue, Heroes, Parks and Recreations, Mad Men,
that's
House,
where I know him
Beat,
from.
And
from,
Scandal.
From Parks and Rec. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I mean, I looked at his IMDb list, and it's like one episode of literally so very many shows. Of course he looks familiar, because you probably see him once a day on TV.
Right. That's quite a career. It's impressive. There are certain people like that.
Yeah, just a little, like, character actor, you know, kind of thing.
It's funny that
it's almost the opposite, like, the opposite of that phenomenon where every famous actor has been on one episode of
Law and Order.
Law and Order.
Yeah. Law and Order. And this is a slight digression, but just really briefly, there's a phenomenon that I've noticed on a few old shows, like, speaking of Murphy Brown, the guy who plays Frank Fontana on Murphy Brown, he was on an episode of Who's the Boss that I saw, and he played a priest. Mm-hmm. And then I saw another episode of Who's the Boss from later on, and he was on it again, but he played a different role. he was like Tony's friend. I was just like, hey, that's Frank Fontana. And first of all, he was a priest in an earlier episode.
Right.
And there was another time that happened on 90210. There was a guy who played like a bellboy, and then he comes back and he plays Brenda's boyfriend. He's like a rich guy. So you know that he wasn't actually supposed to have been a bellboy. And that's how much I've seen 90210 is that I remember who played the bellboy.
That's amazing.
Anyway.
Yeah, this is an American Horror Story. You're not supposed to be a new character altogether.
It's just like, are you really that hard up for somebody to cast that you have to go back and find someone that you've already had on the show?
Oh, well. Yeah, or they just, you know they like the person. I think it's like friendship stuff and whatever. But yeah, it is the most bizarro thing, because you expect, I think, your viewers to watch and retain. I guess it is
something that they probably don't do as much anymore, because everyone's going to be able to rewatch something, whereas like in the 80s you weren't able to just like Who's the Boss. People didn't necessarily expect that you'd have a chance to rewatch it, and its rewatch value is not very good. I'll tell you that.
I haven't actually gone back to do much Who's the Boss rewatching, even though I like Judith Light quite a bit.
Oh, I love Judith Light. I kind of love Who's the Boss. We can talk about this later when we talk more about other episodes, but I will explain why later on.
Okay. I look forward to it. Yeah, so in the next scene, they're in the living room, one of the comfort zones of the Connor household, and Dan's laying on the couch. It seems like after work, like everybody else. And Roseanne comes in her very brightly colored shoulder pad button-up that's turquoise with some interesting shapes on the shoulders, and she's getting everybody ready to go. I noticed that Dan's shirt is a brown plaid that almost exactly matches the couch. Mm-hmm. But there's always a money moment. Mm-hmm. There's a couple in this episode, but DJ and Darlene like fly down the stairs and they demand their money. Darlene says, give us our money. And Roseanne says, your money. And Darlene says, I don't care whose money it is. Just give it to us. And, you know, they're like playfully like defiant, and they're sort of playing the spoiled brat kind of thing. But they're not actually like spoiled children at all. They're playful and sarcastic in the exact same way that their parents are.
Yeah.
And so Darlene has this mouth on her that's really like exactly Roseanne's loudmouth personality. It's not actually spoiled rottenness. It's like this sweet sort of familial bonding kind of thing. They get $5 each and they just like go out to the car or whatever. And this is where Becky's running behind and they're like wondering why she's taking so long. And the kids, you know, come back in and Darlene sort of spills the beans that Becky is taking extra care to look cute for her boyfriend.
Right.
And they like toss the word boyfriend around a lot, even though it's pretty clear that in this episode is the very first time Becky's ever talked to Chip.
Right. I know. I actually thought, I couldn't remember when I first saw this. I was like, oh, does she have a boyfriend already? And then it's like, oh no, never mind. Just a crush.
Well, when I was going back to watch these, I had kind of forgotten about Chip and had already and been expecting it to be Jimmy Meltrigger, because that's her like big love before she meets Mark.
Right.
And so she comes downstairs and she's very dressed up in her embroidered collar button up
and her dangly earrings. Red pants.
Bright red pants. Bright red pants. She's got the look.
And Roseanne says, are we going to be working the lounge tonight?
I know. Oh, she's so harsh. But Lisey Goranson just plays the like horrified, awkward, embarrassed teenager so well. Mm-hmm. It's just nails it so much, because she constantly has like stink face.
Right.
You know, like she's just like, and she just personifies that sensibility so incredibly well, that even though I think in a lot of ways I related most to Darlene, that just being completely horrified by her mother, I relate to so much. I was that at that age just horrified by the very fact of being parented, you know?
Yeah, definitely. She shows her embarrassment a lot more than Darlene.
Yeah, yeah.
And her insecurity. Well, and
it's largely due to the fact that in, I think here, Darlene's, she's just a little too young to feel quite as embarrassed as Becky, who's trying to be independent. She says, please, if you really love me, you'll pretend you're not my parents. And Roseanne and Dan tease her a few times with the hillbilly thing, where Dan says, well, we're going to be at the bowling alley, and Chip's going to be at the bowling alley. And he turns his hat like backwards, and he crosses his eyes, and he goes, we're bound to run into one another.
I know, it's so great. It's so funny. I don't know how he does that with his eyes.
And then Roseanne puts her thumb up her nose. Like, she's doing the, like, picking her nose. She, like, plays along with the sort of hillbilly Appalachian thing. Mm-hmm. We'd never do anything to embarrass you. But then there's this moment where Dan, you know, says that girls always go for guys that remind them of their fathers. And Roseanne says, you know, not if they listen to their mothers. And it's part of that joke that plays out throughout the series where, you know, they put each other down, but they don't really mean it because they love each other more than anything in the world.
Right.
But I also, I really hate that trope of, like, your dad is your practice boyfriend.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy. I mean, it's just, like, it's so retrograde.
I hate it so much. It grosses me out so badly. And it puts me out of this scene a little bit, even though it's the end of the scene, so that's fine. But, like, daddy-daughter dances and stuff, like, all of that just, there's got to be a different way to think about that.
Yeah.
Because it really weirds me out.
And well, yeah, and it just seems just like one of those really lame kind of sitcom lines that is just thrown in, and, like, no one's really thought about the characters. It's just kind of like, this is just something that, it's like a cliche that we can just put in here to, like, end the scene, you know?
Yeah, so I'm not even mad at the writers or anything like that, because people make that, and Roseanne undermines it immediately, which works really well. But that's a thing that just, I've been, obviously because of the Kavanaugh thing, thinking a lot about every little thing that has to do with how young women are thought about in terms of sexuality and growing up, and so that it really does bother me. I also never had a father figure, sorry to bring it down, so it's weirds me out double, because I'm just like, why?
Well, that can't be true. There are so many, there are certain sitcoms, like, I don't know, do you ever see the sitcom The War at Home with Michael Rapaport?
No.
I never really watched it, but I remember when I was living with my roommate, Jessica Cooper. She's listening. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
I don't think she's probably listening, but I'm going to talk about Who's the Boss later, which is our joint favorite show, so it would be a good one for her to hear. But anyway, my roommate, Jessica Cooper, would always talk about The War at Home, because it was on after something that we would watch, and she would start watching it. She'd be like, this is the worst show of all time. It's so offensive, because it's just like, the entire plot in every single episode is just about how this father is, like, obsessed with his daughter's virginity. And, like, you know, he just doesn't want her to, like, date boys. And it's just, like, it's very disturbing.
Gross.
And then there's that other show that John Ritter was on before he died, 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. It's kind of, like, the same thing. It's just, like, this obsession with this hot young daughter and, like, protecting her from, like, all the drooling, like, disgusting boys that you're sure are, like, going to deflower her.
Yeah. You know, and the important part is having control over that.
Yeah.
And claiming as the patriarch ownership over it. Whether they're aware of it or not, that's what it is. I swear to God, the, like, Venn diagram of dudes who shared and liked that viral photo of the dad with his arm around his daughter's prom date holding the gun.
Oh, God.
Did you ever see that?
No.
The Venn diagram of those dudes and dudes who are like, all teenage boys do that about Brett Kavanaugh, I'm certain it's a perfect
photo. Oh, I know, yeah. People cross the line talking about daughters, and instead of, like, making it into, like, I respect women because I have a daughter, it's like,
maybe just respect women because you're a decent human being who recognizes that women are also people equal to you.
Right. And that it's not, like, someone that you have ownership over who's, like, yours that you're worried about and therefore you're offended by rape, you know?
Right. Yeah. When otherwise I wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really gross and weird. I'm not mad at Dan.
No.
Because he doesn't, over the course of the series, he does not display any of that kind of, like, grossness in that particular way.
Yeah, although there are moments. His relationships are very nuanced with his daughters, and we'll talk about that more.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's really great, actually.
Yeah. He's not a creepy patriarch, even though, you know, he's also a pretty recognizably honest depiction of a regular average Joe dad.
Right.
Of course, isn't perfect.
Yeah.
But he's not the war at home, that's for sure.
Right, which I actually haven't seen, so I may be mischaracterizing it, but that is how Jessica described it to me, and then also I had read about it, and I don't think it was received very well, but
yeah.
Anyway.
I'm sure.
But yeah, so in the next scene, they go to the bowling alley, which is so exciting. And I love to see a bowling alley on TV. There's just something about it that's very retro and cozy. And I feel like bowling alleys on TV almost always look the same. But it's not unrealistic because they look the same in real life, too, I find.
Yes. Yep. Oh, you betcha.
And this one has an orange carpet, which I really enjoy. And so we get there. Dan's still doing his hillbilly impression. He's moved into a different venue.
Yes.
Yes. And then we have Crystal being really uptight, and she's just talking about how disgusting the bowling shoes are that Dan's putting on and how there's so many germs in them. And Crystal is just, like, really prissy about bowling, and she's wearing a really cool bowling shirt that's fuchsia.
I love her shirt.
Because she's a lead bowler, right? So she really cares about bowling. Right. And it has a little bowling pin, or bowling ball and bowling pins on it.
I really like that Crystal is a deeply, deeply serious bowler. I loved her shirt. And I was trying to notice some of the other league bowler shirts that were around, and I made note of one of the bowling teams is Lanford Electric, which I thought was really cool. You know, because we have Wellman Plastics and Lanford Electric, and it's basically, this is a scene, this is a working class scene in a working class community with working class people playing a working class sport. And I love that. I also love the scenes of bowling that where you just persistently hear the sound of the bowling ball hitting the pins.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about that hollow sound of a bowling ball hitting those pins that I just really love.
Yeah. Did you go bowling a lot when you were growing up?
No.
Really?
We went bowling every now and then. Yeah. I've been bowling many times, but I'm not a good bowler.
No, me neither. Yeah, I mean, I went a lot as a kid. And we had cosmic bowling, which we did as teenagers.
Yes.
There was a fog machine, some black light action.
Yeah. Black light, a little bit of strobe light here and there.
But yeah, I always had fun as a kid, but I was a really bad bowler. And I remember, like, in junior high one time going with a bunch of friends and I bowled a zero. And everyone was trying to, like, help me. And I was just, like, so embarrassed. I was like, I don't want to fucking bowl anymore. Like, this is awful.
This is bullshit. Yeah. Yeah. I think my highest score ever was a 90. And I was so proud.
Yeah.
I was so proud.
You should be.
I was like, yes. But apparently that's not a high score.
Yeah, I guess not. Better than a zero, though.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. It was a dark day.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right.
And you probably weren't even, like, high or drunk like I was when I was a teen.
No, I just had no wrist strength. I couldn't make the ball go. Like, I could barely hold the ball. I have very small hands.
Oh, I do too. I have small hands and really thin wrists.
Yeah, me too. We're too delicate.
I know, we're basically ballerinas over here.
Where were we?
Oh, yeah. Crystal's flirting with Dan by worrying about his foot hygiene.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a pretty short scene, right? I mean, just the nostalgia of the bowling alley is very nice.
Yeah. And Booker shows up with his own shoes, which I think we're supposed to understand. Dan is maybe a little prissy, because we're always understanding Booker as a little bit prissy.
Yeah.
You know? He is a pre-metrosexual.
Yeah,
but
I think so.
Not really in a metro. Lanford doesn't count as a metro, but he's like, you know, particularly well-groomed fellow for the world that he's living in. I think that's just kind of adding to that. So when he turns out to be okay at bowling, it's maybe a little bit surprising because he's the kind of guy who brings his own shoes.
Right. I think George Clooney looks so cute in this episode. His hair is all big and curly. And I don't understand why he would go and get the dreaded Caesar haircut after this to go on ER. I hate that haircut. And look at his beautiful hair.
It's the worst haircut.
It's so curly and fluffy.
It's so full. Yeah, there's nothing I want to do more than run my hands through George Clooney's hair in this episode.
I know.
It's bouncing as he, you know, takes his shots. It's luscious.
Indeed. That's all I have to say about that, but the Caesar haircut offends my sensibilities to this day.
Yeah, to this very day. Does anybody have that anymore?
I don't think so. No one who's on trend.
I keep my eyes out. Nobody who's on trend, that's for sure. Because the Caesar haircut also requires a lot of wet look product,
mm-hmm.
and that is not in right now.
No.
The next section of this scene, I kind of think of as a separate scene, even though it has the same setting. Because Crystal sort of takes everyone off to go find balls. And so they all kind of walk away, and it's down to Jackie and Booker. And Jackie's jumper in this scene is its own character.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a very, very high-waisted... It's sort of overalls, except that it doesn't have the top part. It's just
like more of a suspender. Suspender look?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's all one piece. I'm calling it a jumper. And I do think these have come back. But it's high-waisted. The straps are suspender-like, but they're attached. But you also, I think she's wearing a belt, too. It's a very complex outfit. And very pleated. It's pleated like, 5 feet out in front of her, basically.
And it's a mock turtleneck, which I hate.
A mock turtleneck.
Just be a regular turtleneck, you know? Just make a decision.
Make a choice here. I agree with you, because I'm actually a big fan of the turtleneck, and I like to unfold and pull it up over my face to hide my face when I'm feeling anxious in a public space.
You can't do that with a mock?
You cannot. Not without looking like a maniac. I'm pretty sure I had a jumper like that in middle school. I had something that was very pleated and the top and the bottom were attached. It's also the mock turtleneck buttons in the back, which I also hate.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Ugh.
When she turned around. I was looking closely at it, too, and I described it in my notes as putrid, the entire look, and it's lavender.
The whole look is no bueno.
And she's trying to get Booker's attention. He looks so cute. It's like, come on, Jackie.
Yeah. But she looks cute. She's really an attractive woman. And I noticed her dimple a lot more in this episode than I have. Somebody instructed her to smile in a particular way to show off her dimple or something. But yeah, her outfit is bananas. So, you know, Booker's like asking her if she's any good. And she says, yeah, pretty good. And Booker says that he hasn't played in a long time, but he used to be a high scorer. And, you know, Jackie's like, we're talking about bowling, Booker. So
that was a good
he's like, yeah, that's you. Thank you. So they make like a bet, which he refers to as a friendly wager, that if he wins, she has to stay the night at his place. She's like, that's pretty friendly. And she complains that it's like a, you know, a little too one-sided. And he says, well, if you lose, we both win. So he's got this sort of like playful arrogance about him that is gross, for instance, on Pete, but it's
right.
Not as gross when it's Clooney.
Well,
you know,
he kind of knows that she likes him, so I think.
Well, that's what makes this whole thing okay, is that it's already very, very clear and understood between them and between the people around them that they're romantically interested in each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, like, betting that, you know, if I win at bowling, you have to sleep with me is gross.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make him a creep for suggesting it, because it's clear that they like each other. Mm-hmm. But she says she has a 160 average and there's no way he'll beat her. Is that, like, good?
I guess it's pretty good. I mean, I think so. I've never bowled a 160. I mean, I have gotten better since my junior high days. So I've bowled, like, you know, 130 or something. But I think 160
that's so
good. Is pretty good. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, like I said, my best was like a 90. So he's like, well, what if you win? And she says, well, then you have to stay the night at my place. And she lets this like perfectly timed pause where he responds, you know, like, ooh, yeah, nice. And she's like scrubbing my bathroom.
Right.
You know, so they've got a bet in place that, you know, if she wins, he has to clean her bathroom. And if he wins, she has to spend the night with him. And we all know what that means. So they shake on it. And it's like basically the tension of the episode. Well, half the tension of the episode. The other half is with Becky and Chip. The other two lovers in Lover's Lane.
Right. Yeah, and so then, like, in the next scene, Roseanne is doing her, like, thing where she tries to distract people, right? And she doesn't enjoy bowling. She's kind of making a show of it. And Dan is... Well, we sort of fade out, and then we fade back in again, and Dan is winning. It's kind of a great showcase for John Goodman, because all you see is him setting up to bowl. You don't see, like, the ball hitting the pins. But you just see him watching it and his reaction and then his celebration and his little dances that he does and everything, which is pretty
Yeah.
Funny.
And so it's really funny. He's such a good physical actor. And before we started this podcast, I don't think I noticed that as much. But man, he is agile.
Yeah, he's so very like aware of what his body's doing and how to convey like emotions with his body, which is not easy to do. So, yeah. So,
yeah.
Roseanne is drinking a Budweiser, I noticed. It wasn't generic this time. Was it misspelled?
I know. I don't know. So I noticed that too.
Yeah, so the Budweiser, that was just an observation. And then Jackie tells her about the bet with Booker.
Yeah. She's like, well, we made a friendly bet. And she's, Roseanne's like, how friendly? Jackie's like, extremely friendly.
Oh, yeah.
And Roseanne says, where was I when Mom and Dad were dropping you on your head?
That's right.
So every opportunity to say something mean, you know, in this like loving and friendly way. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think she's sort of supportive because she knows Jackie likes Booker and the Booker likes her.
And that he's not so bad. Like he hasn't done anything truly terrible.
Not yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's basically that scene, right? And then we move to Darlene and Becky.
So they're at the... What'd you call this? It's like the bowling alley snack bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wrote down the bowling alley cafe, and I was like, that doesn't sound right.
That
I
sounds
think that's
too
just
fancy.
Because it's way too fancy, and it reveals a lot about me and what I think of. But Darlene's very invested in her video game, and Roseanne is lurking around, and she wants to see Chip. And so she asked Darlene, but Darlene promised Becky she wouldn't tell Roseanne, that she wouldn't show Roseanne Chip. And so Roseanne blackmails Darlene with the threat of her public dancing.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, oh, just listen to the music. You know, and she starts swaying and... shaking her shoulders and shimmying and sort of jumping up and down. And Darlene's like, oh my God, stop. Because she's not as old as Becky and so doesn't exhibit horror as often as Becky, but she's not dead.
Right.
She's certainly not immune to the embarrassment of your mom dancing in public. And she's like, I can't stop myself. I must dance. And Darlene, of course, in a big huff is like, okay. I'll tell you. And she points out Chip, and Chip's this like precious little blonde mullet haver, you know, behind the counter with this little soda stand hat and stuff on. He got his little name tag. He's really, you know, he's really cute.
He's cute.
And first of all, I relate to this so much. I am profoundly inclined to embarrass my wife by dancing and singing in public.
Really?
As, Yeah, the older I get, the less I give a shit about what other people think. And sometimes I just feel like dancing and chatting it up with strangers at the grocery store, you know, or like singing along to Stevie Nicks in the rice aisle or something like that. And Emily's does not enjoy that very much. She's like, oh my God, please stop. And I'm like, but I'm having fun. Am I terrible? Am I awful? I just really...
No.
You just have a joie de vivre. It gives me a laugh. I don't like embarrassing my wife in any serious way. Like, if she starts to look actually horrified, I will stop. But I just think I'm a grandpa. I just have a grandpa's sense of humor.
Yeah, you can have a little fun.
I tell grandpa jokes, and I dance and sing at the grocery store and embarrass my wife. But I'm not embarrassed because I don't have this wherewithal and sensibility to be embarrassed by.
Oh, it's just the grocery store, you know? I say let it fly. Do whatever you want.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. So that's that scene, and it's really short and sweet. And, of course, Darlene has betrayed Becky, but who can really blame her?
Well, and then we go back to the Jackie and Booker saga, and Roseanne is again asking Jackie how it's going, and Jackie says, Booker's beating the pants off of me, literally. and
he's gonna have to work to get those pants off.
It's true. It's a onesie. It's not even pants.
And it's got a belt on. It's a lot.
Good luck, Booker. But yeah, so in earlier episodes, we do get a lot of Roseanne and Jackie relationship building in season one, but I really like their rapport in this episode seems to me really finally like it's come together and like this is how we know them. Yeah. They seem really comfortable with each other. So yeah.
I agree.
Their rapport. It works well in this episode.
Right. And Jackie laughs at Roseanne's jokes and Roseanne is like kind of does her like mean thing, but also is like really sort of supportive and helpful in there. And yeah, I really like it too. It definitely has the like older sister, younger sister thing much more smoothly integrated into the dialogue and the acting and everything. And I like it.
Yeah, and there's less tension between them, I think, than there was in the really early episodes. And it's more just like, this is their relationship. And, you know, there are problems with it, but they just accept it for the most part. So,
right.
And so Roseanne says, I'm going to save you from your pitiful self. And then she says, hey, Booker, did you get that infection cleared up? And then Booker drops his ball. He's all like, what?
Yeah, he throws it behind him.
That's right.
I've done that bowling.
Really?
I've done that bowling. I've accidentally let go when it's behind me instead of in front of me. Yeah, it's just a thing. It's fine.
It happens.
That reminds me of, there's a short story by David Sedaris where he's talking about being in the subway with his sister, and I'm assuming it's Amy Sedaris.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, they're just having a day out and a conversation, and as he's getting on the subway and the door is closing, she shouts, good luck with those rape charges.
That's right. I've read that one, too. I love that.
Oh, it's terrible. It's a horrible thing to
That's,
do.
Like, totally their relationship. I love his description of their relationship throughout, like, all of his essays. It's really funny.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's so funny. But that's what that reminded me of a little bit. It's like, Roseanne just shouting, like, this awful thing about Booker. Did you get that infection cleared up? Because, of course, it's the insinuation is that he has an STD.
Right. And then we have our next scene with Becky again. And first of all, I was wondering if this was... And there was, like, one episode from season one that I didn't watch on this go-round. But I was wondering if this was the first scene that we have Becky and Darlene alone together. And I'm not sure. But I kind of... It's a nice moment because Darlene says, like, just why don't you just go up to him? And Becky's like, you can't just go up to a boy and talk to him, you know? And I really like that exchange because, like, Darlene doesn't get, like, why it's a problem because she's, like, a tomboy and she's, like, friends with all these boys and, like, she's young, so she doesn't really get, like, the embarrassment. And so, but
right.
Becky does take her advice, right?
What were you gonna say? Oh, I was just going to say she's not quite at the age where she gets, like, crushes. And actually, I don't think we see a whole lot of Darlene getting crushes. She just, like, meets David and then has a boyfriend.
Yeah.
I think.
Pretty much.
But I was just remembering, there's a scene in an earlier episode of season one where Darlene gets a D.
Oh, yeah.
And is trying to make it look like a B.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't want Becky to give her report card because then Dan and Roseanne will know that it's report card day or whatever.
Right, that's true. So that was the other one with them together. So it's kind of these nice moments between sisters. And I just really like their relationship and the way it evolves. And then we see them in the reboot. And it's such a great connection. And I really hope we see more of that in the Connors. I'm sure we will.
Yeah, the reboot was great with the sisterly connection. I just, like, was really moved by that.
I know, I think I cried during that episode where they have that moment, you know, where they're talking about, like, Mark and...
Yeah.
It's so good.
I know. I was... Yeah, they did such a good job of that. And, like, her going to Becky's Mexican restaurant where she works and drinking together. And it just, like, as adults... I really thought they did marvelously with that.
Mm-hmm. I loved it. So this is one of their early scenes together. And then Becky actually does go up and talk to Chip. And then Roseanne comes up, of course, while she's talking to Chip. And they're having, like, a decent conversation. Like, it kind of goes well with Chip. But Roseanne comes up and Becky looks at her like, oh, my God. And Roseanne just puts on a Southern accent for some reason. She's like, I have two pretzels and... two beef jerkies.
I know. I thought she was, like, kind of doing an impression of Crystal.
Maybe.
What
accent does Crystal have? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, it's kind of Southern, kind of not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an episode later on where they tease Crystal about her Southern accent because she's from Lamport, just like the rest of them. And she goes, my father's from Arkansas.
Oh, I see. Okay,
but I thought she was, like, doing a Crystal-esque accent.
I could see that. Yeah, that makes sense now that you mention it. Well, and that's pretty much it. And she actually doesn't embarrass Becky by revealing her identity. She just kind of, like, goes away after that. And Becky and Chip have a little nice conversation.
Well... he, like, complains to her that his mom wouldn't let him go to the Steel Vipers concert unsupervised. You know, so they like, it's like Becky hits her stride because they get to bond over, like, the deeply uncoolness of their parents. She's like, parents are so uncool.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, like, bonding over dorky parents. And, you know, so what better time for Roseanne to come up and be, like, a complete dork? And she gives Chip a tip, though. And so Chip tip. Hold on. I'm trying to get it right. Chip tip. She gives Chip a tip. And Chip is glad about the tip. And so he's like, man, that lady gave me a tip even though she just brought pretzels. That's so cool.
That's right.
And Becky has this sort of, like, moment of pride, like, yeah, it really was cool. Even though she doesn't, of course, admit that that's her mom. I liked that when Roseanne and Chip are having the conversation where she's ordering the food and being such a weirdo, Becky's face is very close up in the foreground. And she's, like, hiding her face and acting really shifty, which no person would do if they're not trying to... if they're not embarrassed by this, you know, it's, like, so obvious that it's her mom because she's, like, hiding her face and looking horrified.
That's true.
But her face is so close up in the foreground. It's a kind of an odd shot because she's very clear and it's just, like, a moment inside Becky. You know, she looks really pretty and her face is, you know, nicely made up and she's running through these emotions as their eyes shift back and forth. She's just, like, right here in the camera. It's really oddball.
That is weird. I didn't even notice.
Yeah, the kid that plays Chip, his name is Jared Rushton, I think.
Hmm.
Yeah. And he was in Big.
Oh.
He plays the friend of Tom Hanks's kid character.
Okay.
I think. And then he's in Pet Sematary.
Oh, really? Wow, I just watched that. Or Pet Sematary 2.
Or Pet Sematary 2. Yeah, I think it's Pet Sematary 2.
That's the one with Eddie Furlong.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yeah, he plays, like, the enemy of Eddie Furlong.
Oh, okay.
And he's also in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh, wow. Is he the boy child? I don't remember. But he would be older in that. I don't remember how old the kids are.
Yeah, I think so. I remember seeing Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in the movie theater.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And I remember that there's like an older teenage boy with long hair that's in it.
Yeah, that must be him. But unless he's just like some kind of big part.
I don't know. Yeah, but so he's in that. He's got a cool shaped nose. I like the shape of his nose.
Well, he's no JTT, but he's all right.
Nobody is. There will never be another JTT. As long as we're alive.
Irreplaceable. Well, and then we move to DJ, who has got ice cream sandwich all over his face. This is like one of the few things he has to do in this episode. Where he has an ice cream sandwich in his pocket, and then it's also all over his face. He's just being cute.
Yeah. I was saving it for later.
And then Crystal, is Crystal's son there too? I didn't remember seeing him before this.
Right. I don't remember seeing him before this either, but Lonnie's there. Yeah, and it's the weirdest thing to me that he's not in any of the scenes with the kids. Like, he's not playing with them. And I think that actually comes into the show a little bit later. Like, Lonnie is sort of a loner in a way.
Yeah.
And not necessarily, like, really social.
Does Crystal not want him to play with the Connor kids? I thought there was some kind of plot about that, where she thought they were, like, a bad influence.
That makes sense. I vaguely remember that. But yeah, Lonnie's just suddenly sitting next to her.
I know. I was like, who's that kid? He's just, like, all of a sudden they're chatting. And then Booker wins the bet, right?
He surely does.
And then Jackie says, do you really want me there against my will? And he says, absolutely. It's just like one of those moments, one of those questionable moments of like, and I think about this when I watch anything from the 80s, because I feel like it was just a time where there was a lot of that kind of creepy, like, consent humor, you know? I often think of, like, 16 Candles, which is just, like, a grotesque example of so many offenses, but there's this line in 16 Candles where, like, the popular girl is passed out, and Jake Ryan's like, I could violate her in 10 different ways right now. And it's supposed to be, like, a joke. It's just like,
yeah.
Why would
it's
you do
horrifying.
That?
Horrifying. Right. It's really, really upsetting.
It's like, that's like, your first thought when someone's passed out?
Why are you thinking? Exactly. It's so gross.
And it's supposed to be a movie for young people. It's really disturbing.
Right. Molly Ringwald recently wrote an article about a lot of what she had to argue against in certain scenes in a lot of John Hughes movies. And how, you know, what showed up in the movies is actually, like, reduced in its level of, like, creepy rape culture, misogyny stuff from what it was in the scripts. And I'm just like, that's insane. Because, I mean, there's always those scenes where, like, the guys are watching a girl in the bathroom through, like, a hole in the ceiling. Or, like, watching girls through binoculars in their bedroom windows, or and like just rape and consent jokes left and right, and it's shocking.
Yeah, it's really disturbing.
One of my cousins posted this thing on Facebook the other day, which I don't go on very often, but I've been going on to talk about the podcast a little bit, and it was about, you know, he's conservative, and he was posted some joke about Pepe Le Pew being accused of sexual misconduct over the course of, you know, however long of a time. And,
as
you know, like,
ha
ha. Right, exactly. That's my exact thought. It's like, you know, the joke, his joke is supposed to be like, this sexual misconduct stuff is just silly. And like, if we really took it seriously, we'd have to rethink all of these older characters and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I've always thought Pepe Le Pew was really gross. And, you know, even if you watch the cartoons, you can see on that poor cat's face that she's horrified.
I know, it's very disturbing.
Like, wants to be, like, let go. And this skunk just like won't leave her alone and is like grabbing her and molesting her and kissing her, and she's got fear in her eyes and she's a fucking cartoon.
And not only is it about rape, but it's also a derogatory stereotype about French people. There's nothing good about Pepe Le Pew. Let's just put it that way.
There's nothing good about it. Yeah, it actually is a big deal. It's not funny.
Connected with Pepe Le Pew that they don't want to, like, just dismiss that? Because someone really, like, my beloved Pepe Le Pew cartoons are now under scrutiny.
Right. After all Pepe Le Pew has done for society, you're bringing in these ridiculous accusations. She's like, no, it really is terrible. Yeah. That cat is afraid. The people who made this cartoon, who are making it to make people laugh, draw the cat terrified.
Yeah.
Like, it's written into it. It's just time you started caring about the other person's experience and not finding their terror amusing.
Well, and it's just such an example of, like, how these pop culture images just, they help ingrain these concepts. Like, as a young child watching that, you would just assume, well, this is funny because that's, this kind of behavior is funny because that's why they would make a whole cartoon about it. And it's so repetitive that it's like even the youngest child can see, like, okay, I understand the concept of this cartoon to be this skunk terrorizing this like female cat and that's funny.
Yep. Ugh. Anyway. So, I mean,
but Booker's not as bad as Pepe Le Pew because they're flirting and it's like silly and he doesn't really mean it. And then basically, he says, absolutely, and then Jackie says, it would be incredible, or something like that.
Right, yeah. Because he said, would it be so bad?
That's right. Then Booker says, you know what, let's not do it tonight, and not on a bet. He says, not tonight, and not on a bet.
The thing that I thought about this is, like, it's my inclination to give him, who isn't a real person, but is a character, the benefit of the doubt, because I think, you know, his character's funny and kind of cute. He does end up being kind of a turd, but I also think he does it for honorable reasons. I think he does it to make Jackie want him more. Like, you know, it's like to get her worked up because he knows she likes her. And then she says, of course, that it would be incredible. And she's got this like smoldering desire on her face in sitcom context. Like, smoldering desire is very different in like a movie than it is on a sitcom. Mm-hmm. And so I think he does it to like mess with her mind a little bit, not as much to be honorable.
Maybe that's 'cause
then
true,
she's
yeah.
like, I mean, I don't know, but her face falls and, you know, he like walks out and there's audience applause here that really sticks out to me. Because there's laughter and applause throughout the series. But this moment, for some reason, I was noticing the audience applauding and being like, applauding. And being like, why? Why are they applauding? This whole thing is weird. I mean, it's fun and it's cute and it's flirty because there's a strong understanding that they like each other. Mm-hmm. But it's still, like, it's a weird move. The whole thing's weird. Why are you applauding? I don't get it.
Yeah, no, it's true. I don't really understand either. I mean, maybe they're just, like, happy that they like each other. I don't know.
Yeah,
because when he leaves, they do kind of look at each other like, you know, like, they sort of have, like, eye contact and it's like, ow, ow, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it is good that they didn't go home on the bet, I guess.
Yeah.
Although it might have been just as fun if they were like, welp,
yeah, let's
see you
do
later.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, so then it's Rosie's turn. It has to end with Rosie, of course. And so far she's got a 7, which is a little higher than your junior high school.
Right. Not much. And I didn't have any Budweiser, but close.
That's a shame. But she, she says, what inning is it? Which is, you know, this, like, persistent joke of, like, people who don't get sports. We're always, myself included, kind of, like, making the, like, sports ball joke. Yeah. Which, you know, I kind of think, to a certain degree, we being educators, kind of need to know a little bit about sports for the sake of our students. not that I ever use like baseball analogies and stuff like that. I don't do that. But I feel in some ways that it's important to acknowledge that other people take sports seriously and really care about it. But that's like a running joke. People is just like, you know, I want to make a basket on the football court.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm guilty of that. With football especially, because it's so big. Well, actually, there's a football game today, and everyone goes crazy when there's games here in Norman. So it's over, basically, then. Well, but wait, Roseanne bowls last, and then what?
Oh, this is important, because... So Roseanne is, like, getting from Dan and from Jackie and everybody all the, like, distraction and ridiculousness that she gives them, because it's her last turn, and Dan's like in her face teasing her and distracting her the same way that she does. And she says, I can get a strike anytime I want. I pretend like the pins are the kids, and this is your head. To Dan. And then she just like throws it and gets a strike.
Right. Perfect ending. You
know, a perfect ending to a perfect game.
Yes.
Of Roseanne being bad at bowling and then suddenly being good at bowling.
Well, yeah, and so it's a pretty good episode overall because we have our first time where Jackie is really, like, her dating life, her romantic life is sort of a focus, and that becomes, like, a thing that is recurring throughout the series. And then we have Becky and her teenage angst becoming, like, a focal point, and that comes back again, too. And so we have all these great moments with those two characters. And so Roseanne and Dan are more peripheral in this episode, but it still works because they're still like the center that kind of ties everyone together. So,
right. Yeah, exactly.
And the last scene with the credits rolling is the two of them sitting at home and watching pro wrestling together. And then they're like kind of being playful as they are. And Dan's pretending to wrestle Roseanne and kind of like throwing her around on the couch and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and he himself is jumping up and over and around the couch. You know, he's pretending it's like the ropes to the, you know, the ring. And he's, you know, pretending to pin Roseanne. He, you know, she's his opponent. And he does the countdown. But instead of like hitting the floor, he's like kissing her head.
Oh, yeah. You know? Well, and they seem to be and having just a lot of fun. Like, how could you not have fun during that scene if they're laughing?
Of course. Yeah, they're just, like, giggling and laughing and having a really good time. And I just, like, I love that. I love that they're really physical with each other, you know, and they're not just, like, I think about Growing Pains and thinking about the parents on that show and how there's the physicality between the parents is, like, an arm around the shoulder. Maybe occasionally, like, slow dancing somewhere. But Dan and Roseanne touch each other all the time, and they like grapple with each other in this really close way, and I love that. I love that they're really physical with each other. In at risk of sounding corny,
yeah, like
the fact that they touch each other makes their relationship all the more believable, and it seems more like a good and happy marriage. I don't want to moralize about that stuff either. But I'm just thinking about how people said about the show that, you know, they were so, if not immoral, amoral in the way that they related to each other and their children. And I'm just like, oh, this feels like love to me.
Yeah. It's a lot more realistic, true to life in the way couples actually relate to one another, I think, than a lot of sitcoms. Maybe people aren't comfortable seeing that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my Emily and I, you know, we sometimes, like, wrestle, which is the stereotype about lesbians, actually. when I was in high school, this girl in the locker room was, like, talking about what she knew about lesbians. And I didn't know her or anything about her, and she didn't know anything about me either. And, of course, the gym locker room, it was for swim class, is a horrifying experience anyway. But she was saying, well, one thing lesbians do is wrestle. And I was like, really? But it's true, I guess.
Yeah, I never heard that stereotype. But now I know that it's 100% true from my one sample.
It's 100% true across the board. Yep, I'm going to make this generalization. No, I don't know. We do wrestle, though, so it feels good to me. It feels happy.
Oh, yeah, you got to have affection, you know?
Yeah, it's just so nice to see. So, you know, you look at Dan and Roseanne, and you're like, oh, I wish my parents had been happy. Not you, me. I'm so sorry.
My parents are still together. They just celebrated their anniversary. Oh, my gosh. Which one was it? 40th wedding anniversary?
Really?
Yeah.
That's so amazing. That's so amazing. How? My mom is wonderful, and I love her. And she has been married a few times. And she, I think, has decided to not do that anymore. But
yeah,
she did not have a happy marriage to my stepfather, and so when I watched Dan and Roseanne, I was like, oh, that feels like what it should be like, because there were so many things about it that felt true to my life, and then other things about it that didn't quite match, and made me see them as ideal.
Right, so, they're pretty ideal.
Yeah, so. Over the course of the week, you and I watched lots of different iterations of bowling episodes of sitcoms.
Yeah, it's so funny how many there are. Because I think as soon as we decided to talk about this episode, we were like, why are so many sitcom episodes about bowling? And it's just one of those things. It's kind of like the Bachelor auction. That's something I always talk about with sitcoms. They always seem to have bachelor auctions on sitcoms, and they, like, don't ever happen in real life. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I've never been to a bachelor auction, but they sure do happen on TV an awful lot.
They do.
I'm trying to think of a sitcom that has a bachelor auction.
Seinfeld, Frasier. There's a bunch of movies that have them, too, like Groundhog Day.
Oh, yes. God, that's a good
one. Anyway, we'll stop talking about bachelor auctions. Focus on bowling.
Bowling, yeah. Which ones did you watch?
Well, I just watched two, but there are many more that I couldn't watch because they were not available on streaming. Because I looked for The Wonder Years. There was one in Growing Pains, but they weren't available. But I did watch Who's the Boss? There's a bowling episode called Losers and Other Strangers. And then there's a Golden Girls episode called The Competition. So, yeah, the Who's the Boss one was disappointing because there wasn't any actual bowling in it. It was about how Tony was going to a bowling tournament and he didn't think he was going to win because some important team member dropped out or something. And Angela was up for an award for her advertising agency, and she thought she was going to get it. And then it turns out, you know, Tony wins the bowling tournament. Angela doesn't win. She's a very sore loser. And so Tony comes home with a big trophy, and it's like it's pretty much like every Who's the Boss episode, where it's usually like Tony helping Angela through some kind of personal crisis.
Angela, Samantha,
exactly.
Jonathan.
So we had a lot of description from Tony about the bowling tournament, but no actual bowling. But he was wearing a really cool bowling shirt.
Well, at least it has that. That's a shame, though, because I watched, let's see, three different ones. I watched A Different World bowling-ish episode. It wasn't really revolving around bowling, but there was a bowling alley scene because the character that Sinbad plays on this show has to drop out of a bowling competition because he's going to do volunteer work at a community center for youth. And so the colonel takes his place on the team with a professor that's played by the gentleman that plays Phil, Uncle Phil on Fresh Prince, mm-hmm. and Vern, the chef at Hillman. One of the things that I noticed as a kind of a trope across all of these episodes is that someone's either surprisingly good at bowling or surprisingly bad at bowling, mm-hmm. That you don't expect them to be. So in this case, the colonel says he's really good at bowling, and then he ends up being really terrible and getting gutter ball after gutter ball. And he ends up, you know, just dropping off the team. And the joke is that they're going to go find some little girl that was bowling really well over across the bowling alley. But that's really it. And in that one, they don't show the actual bowling either.
I see.
But in the other two that I watched, it shows the balls going in. And it was Cheers, which was so excellent. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fourth season of Cheers episode, maybe. It's got Diane. But it's the Cheers gang have this running rivalry with Gary's Old Town Tavern, and they're always losing. And so Carla suggests bowling as their next competition. And she's kind of the only one who's pretty decent at bowling. And they try to get Woody to come and go bowling because he apparently used to be really good, but he can't because he's emotionally scarred because the last time he bowled, he maimed a man.
I love Woody.
So the episode culminates because Gary tells Sam that if Sam wins, he can have a date with the beautiful blonde bartender at Gary's Old Town Tavern. And if Gary wins, then he can go out with Diane. Meanwhile, neither one of the women are consulted on this bet, on this arrangement either. So it's also, bets and competitions are one of the tropes that go across. Like, somebody's betting somebody about who's going to win, which makes sense in sports, of course. But it ends up that Diane is finally like, I am not going out with Gary. And she reveals that she took 6 semesters of bowling in college. And, you know, her prissy ass gets up and, you know, bowls like a perfect game, basically. And she just gets a little bit of street cred because, of course, she even refers to it as the sport of the great unwashed prior to actually getting down and dirty and bowling and doing well. And so everybody's like, whoa, Diane. Mm-hmm. And then the other one that I watched was a Designing Women episode where the women, Sugar Baker Designs, want to get a contract that this other design firm has, and it's a bunch of guys who are really self-conscious. They've got like a chip on their shoulder about being thought of as gay because they have a design firm. But anyway, it's a competition where you know, whoever wins thinks they're going to get the contract to redesign the bowling alley. And it turns out that Suzanne, Delta Burke's character, who bowls in high heels and won't put her fingers in the holes of the ball because she just got a manicure, she ends up being like the best bowler on the team. Everybody's like, whoa. Mm-hmm. So it's another case of like street cred, or, you know, it's associated with this like working class ethic. And then someone comes in who's really prissy and is really good at it.
Right.
Yeah. And Roseanne does both things. So she, at the beginning, is surprisingly bad, right? Because we're like, wait, you know, she's a working class gal. Mm-hmm. Why isn't she good at bowling? And then at the end, she shows them all, right? Like, she is actually really good and she just doesn't care, maybe?
Yeah, something. That's true. Yeah, so. And it does seem like, I mean, I guess bowling is, it's good for sitcom for many reasons, but because it's the kind of thing that, like, anyone can do. It's like a common activity. It's available in any town, right? And it's an easy thing to film because you just get a bowling alley set and it's pretty cheap, and it's not like taking the cast to a baseball game or something like that, you know?
Right, yeah. It's indoors and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so it seems like a really easy thing for sitcoms to do. But I also feel like, I don't know, I thought bowling was really popular in the 80s, but then I looked it up online and it seems like people seem to think it was on the decline in the 80s in popularity, because I guess it was really popular in the 60s. So, who knew?
Oh.
It still seemed really popular to me in the 80s.
There's also a bowling episode of The Cosby Show,
oh, yeah.
Which I did not watch. I mean, it's the same question as with Roseanne, like, how much of this cultural heritage do we need to throw away? God, Bill Cosby's so disappointing. I loved that show. And I just don't want to see his face.
Well, yeah.
Does it make sense to throw away all these other things too? And I had kind of forgotten, but it was so impactful for people.
Well, yeah,
know?
And again, it is the effort of many. It's not just him. It was just driven by his comedy and everything. And of course, he was the star, so it's really hard. But especially with Bill Cosby, because what he did is so disturbing to think about.
Yeah, so egregious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, saying a lot of racist things is really egregious. It is. But it's not the kind of thing you send someone to prison for.
Right.
And
it's not like an actual rape. Predator type behavior, you know.
Right. Drugging and raping a bunch of women is a whole other thing.
Yeah.
And it's real bad. So
bowling.
Bowling.
But yeah.
I also really desperately want to go bowling.
I know, yeah. I do too. It's time, but... Yeah, so yeah. Lots of bowling episodes, and I do think it's kind of become known as like a working class sport for some reason. I mean, I don't really know why.
I think it's actually Anthony on Designing Women says, like, anything that you can eat a hot dog and do at the same time is not a sport, it's a game.
I love Anthony. Meshach.
Yeah, Meshach Taylor. So
exactly. Like, yeah. It's cheap, you don't have to be in shape. Anyone can go, kids, old people, you know, middle-aged people, whatever. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I definitely thought of Who's the Boss right away because that, and I did say I was going to talk about it. I won't talk about it that much because we're almost done here. But Who's the Boss is like the most, it's just a very simplistic show. And I kind of love it anyway, but about like class. It's so simplistic in its treatment of classes. Like, Tony is working class, therefore he likes to bowl. And, like, Angela is upper class, so she doesn't bowl, you know? And it's just like, of course Tony would win a bowling trophy and be excited about that, because that's, like, his stereotypical character, you know? But I also just love Who's the Boss, because I feel like it's so kind of lame, but I think all of the cast is really good. And I think they really kind of somehow rise above that, and like they have really great chemistry, and I love Katherine Helmand as Mona.
Oh yeah.
But it's actually the Mona's first show the I ever wrote show. An academic paper about when I was in college. I wrote a paper about Who's the Boss for my literary and cultural studies class, and it was really fun and exciting, and my professor really liked it. It was like the first time I ever wrote anything about TV.
Yeah, I want to read it.
I don't know how
you don't
I
have
would,
to send it to me.
You know, that was a long
how
time
would
ago.
You do it? Yeah. Well, but yeah. I guess that's it.
Yeah. So a fine episode of Roseanne. And next time we'll probably move into season 2. Soon will be the Connors as well. So we're very excited about that.
Thanks everybody for listening. If you are listening and you feel like it, you should rate and review us on iTunes.
That, definitely.
Yeah.
But only if it's like a really good review. No, you can be honest. We won't be bad.
Yeah, be honest. It's all right.
Thank you for listening to 714 Delaware Street, with theme music by Matt Schatz and artwork by Emily Zuzak. Please stay tuned for more episodes discussing Roseanne and the Connors.